The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's go ahead with an article that's kind of an inspirational article, and it's kind of pertinent because of the problems that the post office has had over the past couple months. Thank you, Mr. Postman. And the appreciation delivered by an 11-year-old girl's return to sender from grateful Postal Service employees nationwide. Many Americans have felt isolated and frayed this year, and the Weber family of Sioux Falls, South Dakota is no different. But 11-year-old Emerson Weber had a hobby that turned into a remarkable antidote. Em writes letters, lots of letters. One day last spring, she even wrote to her mail carrier. "I wanted to thank you for taking my letters and delivering them," she said. "You are very important to me." Pretty young girl, big hair packed up on top of her head, nice smile, holding some letters up in her hand. In no time at all, Em's simple thank you was shared around the United States Postal Service. Many of the workers who read her thank you note were won back. Her father, Hugh Weber, a managing director at a design company, was so moved by the response that he took to Twitter in May, mid-quarantine, to share his appreciation of the outpouring of love and the marvelous girl at the center of it all. Emerson, my 11-year-old, is on a bit of a wild ride with the USPS and our local mail carrier, Doug, and I think there's a deeper message to it all. First, the backstory. Em has a serious letter-writing habit. She maintains active correspondence over a dozen of her favorite people, and if you've been lucky recipients of one of Em's hand-decorated letters and envelopes, then you have a pretty good idea of the joy they bring. A letter from Emerson is likely to include some art, a joke or two, a mention of her younger brother, confessions of her love for Taylor Swift, and enough questions to guarantee a response. So when she decided to thank our mail carrier for the service he provided us, she left nothing out. In went Taylor Swift. In went the little brother. In went the jokes. Why do you never see elephants hiding in trees? Because they're really good at it. Em wrote, "I'm Emerson. You may know me as the person who lives there that writes a lot of letters and decorated the envelopes. Well, I wanted to thank you for taking my letters and delivering them. You are very important to me, and I make people happy with my letters. But you do, too." There's a picture of her mail carrier, Doug. Looks like he's a middle-aged man with a white goatee and gray hair. Good-looking gentleman, tall, slender. She continued, "The reason you are very important in my life is because I don't have a phone. So how else am I supposed to stay in touch with our friends? You make it possible." She put it in the box and smiled when he took it, and that was enough. The next day, a package arrived with some stamps and two letters. Doug had shared Em's letters with the supervisor, Sarah, and they both wanted to share how touched they were. Sarah said that as an essential worker, Doug might not be able to maintain regular correspondence, but she sure could. Em started writing that very afternoon. This is when things got interesting. The next week, we got a letter addressed to Mr. and Mrs. Weber. It seems that Sarah had shared Em's note as a token of thanks in the internal USPS newsletter for the Western United States, and there were postal folks that wanted to thank her. Today, we saw Doug getting out of the truck with two boxes of letters from around the country. We snapped a quick photo through the door as he and Emerson met for the first time. It was a beautiful moment of silent reciprocity. These letters are so deeply human. They are filled with family, pets, hobbies, community, and an overwhelming sense of kindness. Because Em was fully vulnerable in her note, they were two. Em shared jokes, so they shared jokes. Em shared her brother, so every gift that was sent to came duplicate. Em shared Taylor Swift, and it turns out that the USPS is filled with lots of undercover Swifties. One maintenance manager from Minnesota wanted to inspire her to start collecting stamps, so he sent along two stamps of his own from the bulletin board in his office to start a collection. They sent stamps she used as well, stamps for her to write back, stamps for her to write to others, stamps, 218 by Em's count. But there was something more in these letters. People felt seen, some for the first time in a long time. I work alone in a small rural post office. My kids all live far away. Not a lot of people think about how hard we work. One wrote, "I can't tell you how much it means to read your letter." Author, another. I have a son in Kuwait, and if you have a second to send him a letter, he would love it. And another. I know you can't write back to all of us, but maybe I can drop you a line from time to time. With dozens of new pen pals, Em did what she does best. She wrote the dad. She wrote the son. She assured the secret Swifties not to embarrass, because her dad likes T. Swift, too. She acknowledged that there were lots of letters, but she had time. She sees them all. There's another picture of her sitting down writing in some of her letters, which are absolutely beautifully decorated. Flowers, trees, all different kinds of designs. Wow, that's cool. I'm not sharing this because I'm a proud dad. I'm sharing it because it's relatively easy. If we take the time to give others the one thing they need to be well, human connection. If you, all of you who listen to this regularly, remember a couple of weeks ago or a month or so ago, we had an article about a lady who writes a note a day to somebody. It's kind of like what Emmy's doing. I have a friend who says we all just want to be seen, known, and loved. Em does this boldly. I want to be bold and brave like Em. We've all been in a moment of physical isolation that is amplifying a real epidemic of loneliness, anxiety, and depression. I've been feeling it personally. While in quarantine, I responded to hundreds of DMs, direct messages, from people who are feeling this disconnect. I heard from college students to senior executives who are stressed, worried, and or afraid. I have incredible family and friends, but the truth is that I needed more, and sending texts via an app has been a small step I needed. Em's lesson to me were simple. It's the small things that matter most. Send a letter. Make a call. Practice self-care. Take a step of boldness for yourself or for others. And thank your mail carrier. They are working extremely hard to keep us all connected. And if you've gotten this far, just know that you can start the same waves of goodness with the people you can count on. Respect and love. Just tell them that you miss them, love them, or just see them. Twitter shared the love, too. Thanks for making me start my Monday with a good, happy cry. Tico Diva, Patrice. This tweet is the best tweet I've read in a long time. The power of caring. Congrats on raising a kind child, you. No higher accomplishment. Tell Em to keep sending those letters. I'd personally take a handwritten mail note over a text or email any day. Nicole Wheeler. Please tell Em I do pen palling and have made it my mission to write to everyone in my address book several times over. People love to get mail, and that's from Library Woman. And you have an innate sense of sympathy, the singer Taylor Swift wrote to Emerson in a note. She got a note from Taylor. How's that cool as that? And then the drama in real life is the next thing we'll look at. Stowaway in a Landing Gear. This Reader's Digest classic from 50 years ago tells the thrilling story of a teen who made a daring escape from Cuba in the frigid belly of a transatlantic DC-8. And there's a picture here of two young men racing rapidly toward the tail end of a jet, obviously waiting to get ready to take off. The jet engines of Iberia Airlines DC-8 thundered in an air-splitting crescendo as the big plane taxied toward where we huddled in the tall grass, just off the end of the runway at Havana's Jose Marti Airport. For months, my friend Jose Perez Blanco and I had been planning to stow away in the wheel well on this flight, number 904, Iberia's weekly nonstop run from Havana to Madrid. Now in the late afternoon of June 3, 1969, our movement had come. We realized that we were pretty young to be taking such a big gamble. I was 17, Jorge 16. But we were both determined to escape from Cuba, and our plans had been made carefully. We knew that departing airliners taxied to the end of the 11,500-foot runway, stopped momentarily after turning around, and then roared at full throttle down the runway to take off. We wore rubber-soled shoes to aid us in crawling up the wheels and carrying ropes to secure ourselves inside. The wheel well, we had also stuffed cotton in our ears as protection against the shriek of the four jet engines. Now we lay sweating with fear as the massive craft swung onto about face, the jet blast flattening the grass all around us. "Let's run," I shouted to Jorge. We dashed onto the runway and sprinted towards the left-hand wheels of the momentarily stationary plane. As Jorge began to scramble up the 42-inch high tires, I saw there was not room for us both in the single well. "I'll try the other side," I shouted. I climbed quickly onto the right wheels, grabbed a strut, and twisting irregularly pulled myself into the semi-dark well. The plane began rolling immediately, and I grabbed some machinery to keep from falling out. The roar of the engines nearly deafened me. As we became airborne, the used double wheels, scorching hot from takeoff, began folding into the compartment. I tried to flatten myself against the overhead as they came, closer and closer. Then, in desperation, I pushed at them with my feet. But they pressed powerfully upward, squeezing me against the roof of the well. Just when I felt that it would be crushed, the wheels locked in place, and the bay doors beneath them closed, plunging me into darkness. So there I was, my 5'4", 140-pound frame, literally wedged in amid a spaghetti-like maze of conduits and machinery. I could not move enough to tie myself to anything. Then, before I had time to catch my breath, the bay door suddenly dropped open again, and the wheels stretched out of their landing position. I held on for dear life, swinging over the abyss, wondering whether I had been spotted, whether even now the plane was turning back in hand to hand me over to Castro's police. By the time the wheels began retreating again, I had seen a bit of extra space among all the machinery, where I could safely squeeze. Now I knew there was room for me, even though I could scarcely breathe. After a few minutes, I touched one of the tires and found that it had cooled off. I swallowed some aspirin tablets against a head-splitting noise and began to wish I had worn something warmer than my light sports shirt and green fatigues. Up in the cockpit of the DC-8, Captain Valentin Vara del Rey, 44, had settled into the routine of the overnight flight, which would last 8 hours and 20 minutes. Takeoff had been normal with the aircraft and its 147 passengers, plus a crew of 10, lifting off at 170 miles per hour. But right after liftoff, something unusual had happened. A light on the instrument panel had remained on, indicating proper restriction of the landing gear. "Are you having difficulty?" the control tower asked. "Yes," replied Vara del Rey. "There is an indication that the right wheel hasn't closed properly. I'll repeat the procedure." The capper lowered the landing gear, then raised it again. This time the red light blinked out. Dismissing the innocent as a minor malfunction, the captain turned his attention to the climbing to the assigned cruising altitude. On leaving out, he observed that the temperature outside was 41 degrees below zero. Shivering uncontrollably from the bitter cold, I wondered if Jorge had made it into the other wheel well, and I began thinking about what had brought me to this desperate situation. I thought about my parents and my girlfriend, Maria Esther, and wondered what they would think when they learned what I had done. My father is a plumber, and I have 4 brothers and a sister. We are poor, like most Cubans. Our house in Havana has just 1 large room. Food was scarce and strictly rationed. About the only fun I had was playing baseball and walking with Maria Esther along the seawall. Then when I turned 16, the government shipped me off to a vocational school in Betancourt, a sugarcane village in Matanzas province. There I was supposed to, as a team, learn welding, but classes were often interrupted to send us off to plant cane. Young as I was tired of living in a state that controlled everyone's life. I dreamed of freedom. I wanted to become an artist and live in the United States, where I had an uncle. I knew that thousands of Cubans had gotten to America and had done well there. At the time approached when I could be drafted, I thought more and more of trying to get away. But how? I knew that 2 plane loads of people were allowed to leave Havana for Miami each day, but there was a waiting list of 800,000 people for these flights. Also, if you signed up to leave, the government looked at you as a gusano, a worm, and life became even less bearable. My hopes seemed futile. Then I met Jorge at a Havana baseball game. We got to talking, and I found out that Jorge, like me, was disillusioned with Cuba. "The system takes away your freedom forever," he complained. Jorge told me about the weekly flights to Madrid. Twice we went to the airport to reconnoiter. Once a DC-8 took off and flew directly over us. The wheels were still down, and we could see into the well compartments. "There's enough room in there for me," I remember saying. Those were my thoughts as I lay on the freezing darkness more than 5 miles above the Atlantic Ocean. By now we had been in the air for about an hour, and I was getting lightheaded. Was it really only a few hours earlier that I had bicycled through the rain with Jorge and hidden in the grass? Was Jorge safe? My parents? Maria Esther? I drifted into unconsciousness. The sun rose over the Atlantic like a great golden globe, its rays glinting off the silver and red fuselage of Iberia's DC-8. As it crossed the European coast higher over Portugal. With the end of the 5,563-mile flight in sight, Captain Van der Rey began his descent towards Madrid's Bajaras Airport. Arrival would be at 8 a.m. local time. He told his passengers over the intercom, and the weather in Madrid was sunny and pleasant. Shortly after passing over Toledo, Vara del Rey let down his landing gear. As always, the maneuver was accompanied by a buffeting as the wheels hit the slipstream at 200-mile-an-hour turbulence, swirled through the wheel wells. Now the airplane went into its final approach. Now a spurt of flame and smoke from the tires as DC-8 touched down at about 140 miles per hour. It was a perfect landing. No bumps. After a brief post-flight check, Vero Del Rey walked down the ramp steps and stood by the nose of his plane, waiting for a car to pick it up along with his crew. Nearby, there was a sudden soft plop as the frozen body of Armando Sacaro Ramirez fell to the concrete apron beneath the plane. Jose Roca Laxaza, a security guard, was the first to reach the crumpled figure. "When I touched his clothes, they were frozen stiff as wood," Rocha Lorenzo said. "All it did was make a strange sound, kind of a moan." "I couldn't believe it at first," Vera Del Rey said. "But then I went over to see him. He had ice over his nose and mouth and its color. As he watched the unconscious boy being burled into a truck, the captain kept exclaiming to himself, 'Impossible! Impossible!' The first thing I remember after losing consciousness was hitting the ground at the Madrid airport. Then I blacked out again and woke up later at the Grand Hospital de la Beneficia in downtown Madrid, more dead than alive. And there's a picture of him. And he looks okay, but he also looks like he had a rough ride." When they took my temperature, it was so low that it did not even register on the thermometer. "Am I in Spain?" was my first question, and then, "Where's Jorge?" Jorge is believed to have been knocked down by the jet blast while trying to climb into the other wheel well, and to have been put in prison in Cuba. Doctors later said that my condition was comparable to that of a patient undergoing deep freeze surgery, a delicate process performed only under carefully controlled conditions. Dr. Jose Maria Pajares, who cared for me, called my survival a medical miracle, and in truth, I feel lucky to be alive. Editor's note, experts cited at the time of Sacarraza's Ramirez flame estimated that at altitude at 29,000 feet at a temperature of 41 degrees below zero, the approximate conditions in the wheel bed that day, a person could be expected to live only a few minutes. An engineer said the chances of not being crushed by the retractable double wheels were 1 in 1,000,000. A few days after my escape, I was up and around the hospital, playing cards with my police guard and reading stacks of letters from all over the world. I especially liked one from a girl in California. "You are a hero," she wrote, "but not very wise." My uncle, who lives in New Jersey, telephoned and invited me to come live with him. The International Rescue Committee arranged my passage as they continued to help me. I am fine now. I live with my uncle and go to school to learn English. I still hope to study to be an artist. I want to be a good citizen and contribute something to this country, for I love it here. You can smell freedom in the air. I often think of my friend Jorge. We both knew the risk we were taking and that we might be killed in our attempt to escape Cuba. But it seemed worth the chance. Even knowing the risk, I would try to escape again if I had to. Armando Sacaro Ramirez is now 69 and lives in Virginia. He retired from the transportation industry. He and his wife have 4 children and 12 grandchildren. This story originally appeared in January 1970 of Reader's Digest. I know this is going to be broadcast on September 22nd, but I'm recording this on August the 26th, and today is the day of the dog. And the article I'm going to read now is "The Best of America, the Smartest Dog in America Is." And there's pictures of all different kinds of dogs, anywhere from a looks like a little Maltese to a German Shepherd to all different kinds. RD's editor-in-chief was convinced that his beloved Sadie was the most brilliant canine in the land. Readers may have persuaded him otherwise. "In my Dear Reader column, I issued a challenge, if your dog is as smart as our Sadie, I'll grant you a year's subscription. I didn't expect much from this tongue-in-cheek's wager, but 400 replies later, I see I badly underestimated the situation. After all, these are your dogs I was woofing about, and your stories of sly, wry, silly companions were so poignant and funny that we decided to publish a kennel load of them. One reader did earn a free R&D because of her poo's teaching feats. But, let's be clear, Sadie is still co-champ. The winner. Colby taught a toddler to walk. I was sitting in the living room, keeping an eye on the 1-year-old daughter, Rachel, who was crawling around. Colby, a retired guide dog, was lying nearby, kind of half asleep. Rachel crawled over and pushed herself up as she was leaning on his back. She started rocking back and forth, and then Colby very slowly got up. I thought she was tired of Rachel and was leaving. But as he got up, Rachel stood with him, holding on to his back. Colby stood there for a bit and then slowly started walking. Rachel took a few steps with him and then plopped on her bottom. Colby sank to the floor. In a bit, Rachel started leaning on his back again. Again he rose and started walking. Rachel took a few steps, wobbled, and sank to the floor. This scenario was repeated over and over. At first I couldn't figure it out. Finally I did. Colby was teaching Rachel to walk. Robin C. Cherico, Las Vegas, Nevada. And there's a picture of Colby. It looks like a black lab. Nestle gets bright ideas. My 8-month-old Havanese puppy, Nestle, who's chocolate brown, by the way, there's a picture, sleeps in a wire cage right next to my bed, and next to her is a three-way touch lamp. I turn it on at 5 when I get up to let her out. One morning, she started being restless at 4:15. I told her to go back to sleep. She wouldn't. Then I heard her pawing at the lamp. At 4:30, she turned it on. I finally got up and put her out, and she had to potty. I thought it was a fluke. 2 days later, at 4:35 a.m., she did it again. This time, she tapped the lamp 3 times to get the brightest setting. Her Royal Highness wants up. A few weeks later, at 4:24 a.m., the light went on again. She's done this multiple times when she needs to go out, so now the dog controls what time I get up. Liz Moore from Post Falls, Idaho. Macy conjures imaginary visitors. We had 2 dogs, Tonka, the sweetest Rottweiler in the history of the world, and Macy, the general's pit bull. We had only one Kong chew toy, and Tonka liked to sleep with it between her front paws. And Macy wanted to play with Kong, Tonka would waken, lift his eyebrow, and warn Macy to leave the toy alone. The one thing that united these rivals was the appearance of anyone outside the window. Both would jump to their feet, run to the window, and bark. One day, Macy developed a strategy. She jumped up, started barking, and ran to the window. Of course, Tonka followed. As Tonka searched for the intruder, Macy circled back, grabbed the Kong between her smirking lips, and trotted to her corner. Her little game worked for years. David Maupin, Midlothian, Virginia. Griffin knows how to whisper. Peggy Mesham, Chatham, New Jersey. Texas joined the final journey. My wife raised Texas from a 6-week-old pup into a tall, playful 90-pound boxer who never left her side. He was truly a gentle giant. He faithfully slept at the foot of our bed for 9 years and covered with her pink bathrobe. Then my wife got sick with ALS. When she went into hospice, she continually asked to see Tex. So one day I borrowed a service dog blanket and took him to see her. We rode the elevator up to her floor, and when the door opened, he bounded into the room. How he knew which room, I don't know. When I got there, Tex was on the foot of the hospital bed, his large paw already in my wife's hand. Back at home that night, Tex was restless, and I would not sleep in his bed. So he slept on the floor near me. The next morning, I found he had passed away. My beautiful wife of 46 passed away the next day. I have the ashes of both, and this summer I spread them together in a small stream in Wyoming, high in the Rocky Mountains, where they both love to travel and play together. Jim Sherrard, Plano, Texas. Oh, that's so sad. Skippy knows who is deaf. Almost as soon as our Welsh Corgi, Skippy, came to live with us, she sensed my children and I cannot hear. When someone comes to the door, she jumps up, runs to make sure a guest is there, and then runs to nudge me until I follow her to the door. Same with my children. But with my husband, who has perfect hearing, Skippy doesn't nudge. She barks at him. And if Skippy needs to wake up at night, she rises on her hind legs and nudges me or my children awake. But with my husband, she goes to his side of the bed and barks. Pretty smart dog, huh? Becky Myers in Cedarville, Michigan. Abby runs the Feynman's Recycling. Our Australian Shepherd comes running when she hears the crink of an empty water bottle, the sound of a cereal box being flattened, or her favorite, a plastic litter dish ready to go out. Why? She's a master recycler. She constantly patrols our house for recyclables to grab and take to our garage recycling bin. And if she wants a treat, she brings me an empty cardboard box. Diane Schroeder, Norman, Oklahoma. We live in Colorado, where walking the dogs outside is not always a viable option, and Bertie is the number one treadmill master. So running on a treadmill is a wonderful trick to teach pooches. I was thrilled by my puppy's ability to learn so quickly with so much enthusiasm. What I did not appreciate until much later was how well I had trained her to remain on the treadmill until I gave a release command. It was Christmas. The family had gathered from hundreds of miles away. The grandchildren were excited to open the gifts, and the adults were ready to eat. But first I had to show off the new pup's treadmill trick. I knew Birdie would impress them with the way she followed my commands. Go to the treadmill room, get positioned just right, wait for the machine to turn on, and most important, proceed to walk until instructed otherwise. Birdie did not falter. She remained on the treadmill even after she gave a warning bark. Birdie tells us she must use the bathroom by barking once. But my husband and I were confident that we could keep showing off our pup's athletic ability and did not heed her. She barked several more times. Then it happened. First, Birdie went number one, and in a large part it went unnoticed for a moment. Then Birdie went number two, which could not go unnoticed. Birdie runs, not walks, on the treadmill at 5.6 miles per hour. When the number who hits the treadmill at 5.6 miles per hour, it is shot off the back of the treadmill like buckshot and into everything in its path. The grandchildren were in awe. The adults disgusted. My husband and I mortified. The dog, however, was pleasantly enjoying herself, since now she is up for a long run. I quickly excused her and went to clean up the mess that I believe was caused by teaching the puppy to remain on the treadmill no matter what. I must say that Christmas 2012 is still talked about, but not always with a smile. Tammy Farringer, Pete's, Colorado. Peyton knows when it's Saturday. When I come home from errands, he runs to his bed. He doesn't do that any other day. Linda Bryson, Skymar, California. Shadow outsmarted his trainers. We had put our Belgian sheepdog Shadow to sleep yesterday. He was hands down the worst dog I've ever had. Not so much a super dog as a super bad dog. For the first 2 years of his life, we worked relentlessly to train him to do the basic things. He balked at all of it. When made to lie down, he would roll on his back and cry out as if he were being beaten. If pushed too hard, he would bite. Never to draw blood, but enough to let you know who was in charge. Frustrated, we sent him to a professional trainer who took him into his home to work with him one-on-one. After the agreed-upon 2 weeks of training, the handler called and sleeplessly asked for another 2 weeks with Shadow, free of charge, as he had been unable to make any progress. In another 2 weeks, we got the same phone call. So after 6 weeks, the dog trainer returned our dog with apologies, saying this was the first dog he'd ever deemed untrainable. Shadow appeared quite pleased with himself. For all of his 13 years, Shadow bested us, allowing us the privilege of living in his home. On his last days, my daughter commented, "Mom, I know he doesn't feel good because he is not growling at me when I kiss his face." That was him. Shadow was a genius. How else could he have compelled us to love the worst dog in the world? Julie Campbell, Mineral Wells, Texas. Oh, I used to live in Mineral Wells. Misty mourns for Dad. When my husband Jack was sick and in and out of the hospital and rehab centers, every time I came home, Misty would sit at the gate and wait to see whether he came out of the car. After he died, she would sit at the gate waiting for him to come in. I knew that I needed to find a way of giving Misty closure. So at about a week after his funeral, I took her to the cemetery with me. As we walked up to his grave, I said to her, "Misty, this is where Dad is now." Not sure what to expect, she started sniffing the broken ground, crying. Then she walked to me and leaned against my leg. I knelt down and we both cried. And from that point on, she never waited at the gate for him again. Where most dogs are taught to shake hands, Diesel learned to move with the cue, "Show me the money." Larissa Jeanette, Shipping, Michigan. By the way, the previous one was a letter Riker, Taylorsville, Kentucky. Molly fetches his heart medicine. When I was sick and very weak upstairs with the flu, my husband Ray was working on the lowest floor of our split level. All of a sudden, my heart rate started to speed up. Oh, my. I'd forgotten to take the medicine that helps regulate my heartbeat for 3 days. That can be fatal. As I was going to die, I yelled for Ray, but he couldn't hear. Then our toy fox terrier, Molly, ran into the room. I could bell her to get Daddy. I tried again, and finally she ran out of the room and down the stairs. I heard her barking frantically. Ray rushed upstairs and got my medicine. I believe that Molly saved my life that day. Valerie Magpaw, Brunswick, Ohio. Loki nursed the cancer patient. I was in my 30s when I was diagnosed with a rare gastrointestinal cancer. I was quite sick after surgery and chemotherapy, and having a hard time with fatigue, depression, and anxiety. My Siberian husky rescued Loki, but gently poked me from my nest on the couch when he wanted some exercise. Often I didn't want to go, but the exercise, the fresh air, feeling needed when I had been the needy one for so long, it all helped. Loki got me moving and got me stronger, and when my own willpower wasn't enough, and when the tears and frustration came, he'd curl up on my lap, yes, a 65-pound lap dog, and look into my eyes. Somehow I knew tomorrow would be a better day. Christine Barzak, Lakeview, New York. Chemo can do anything. Here are three things to know about our superhero dog, Kemo Sabe, Kemo for short, whose name means trusted scout or faithful friend. Number one, once a burglar was trying to break into our garage when Kemo showed up. It wasn't the fact there was this huge dog barking a deep, powerful voice that made him leave his pry bar and another sort of tool. It was the snapping teeth, which sounded like a 600-pound alligator. Number two, a neighbor stopped by to share some leftover chicken salad. My sister and I were home from college and did not remember where the bowls were. After we retrieved the bowl a couple times, Kemo disappeared. Kemo dropped a dog bowl on the neighbor's toe, looking back and forth between the chicken salad and her bowl. Number three, one morning, my mom made pancakes that weren't so good, which my dad and I had alluded to. Her response? She gave them to the normally ravenous Kemo, who daintily took them to the door, went out to the backyard, and buried them. That's great. Jim Story, Kenosha, Wisconsin. Brandy knows more than 200 words in English and 50 in Spanish. Magdalena Jacobo, San Bernardino, California. Roxy finds missing lawn tools. One day I was using the string trimmer in the backyard when it suddenly stopped working correctly. Upon examination, I noticed the screw on bump knob at the bottom of the holes the string assembly in place had come off. As I was about to begin my methodical grid search of the backyard, Roxy, our red Queensland heeler, trotted over to one of the many bushes to get her tennis ball. As she came prancing over to me to play fetch, I told her I couldn't, that I had to find the part. With that, she dropped her ball between my feet, looked up at me. I was about to tell her again that I wouldn't play, and I noticed her ball was the knob to my string trimmer, and her look was one of, is this what you were wanting? Needless to say, the string trimmer was put down for a few minutes while we played fetch with her tennis ball. Keith White, Chesterfield, Virginia. Jack anticipates seizures. Our dog Jack runs to our dog Buddy when one of Buddy's seizures is about to happen, then sits next to him looking outward to protect Buddy until it passes and he can walk. Jack was not trained for this. Virginia Matheny, Lynn Haven, Florida. Binky treats migraines. I get migraines. And Binky knows when they are bad, no matter where she is or wherever the noise around us. Binky comes bounding straight toward me on a mission to assuage the pain and depression that come with the migraines. She licks my face fast and hard, trying her best to let all of my pain away. If I am lying down, I better be prepared, because she will jump on my chest and face me down like a hunk of meat, taking on the challenge of licking me into well-being again. Elaine Perkins, Louisville, Kentucky. Mackenzie is a fantastic actor. Mackenzie grew up in a farmhouse initially. The fence around the property was old and several large gaps, so I reinforced the bottom with chicken wire and thought all was well. Mackenzie would spend his day frolicking in a large lion while Connie and I were at work and McKenna was at school. One day, while on a job in the area, I stopped home to visit. As I pulled up to the driveway, I saw Mackenzie outside the fence playing in the daisy, dancing and nosing at a large butterfly hovering just out of his reach. I watched Mackenzie enjoying himself until suddenly he realized he wasn't alone. He turned one look at me and hightailed it to a hole under the fence, wriggling back into the yard. He ran around to the rear of the house, the place where he was usually asleep when we came home. As I stood and watched, Mackenzie then proceeded to come around the corner of the house, stretching as if he had just woken up. Then, continuing his act, he looked at me as if he had just noticed I was home and excited he came up to the fence, where he sat in his proud boy stance, as if he had been good all day and was glad to see me. I laughed as I opened the gate, and then I stood and gave him a frown. With my hands on my hips, I asked the little faker where the hole was. To my surprise, he lowered his ears and dejectedly walked over to the spot in the fence where he had early struggled through, and sat down looking at me. I laughed so hard I cried. John Bytek in Jackson, Michigan. And the last article, the last item was Gus Reed's Reader's Digest. Jennifer Gordon from Toms River, New Jersey. Now to Consumer Reports. Paying for health care in the age of coronavirus. Diagnosing and treating this virus can get expensive, even if you're working insured, but especially if you've lost your job and your coverage. Here are strategies that can help you keep your costs under control. And I hope this doesn't apply to any of you listening, but if it does, I hope it's worthwhile. Even before the coronavirus outbreak hit earlier this year, American finances were fragile. 4 in 10 people in the U.S. said that the previous 2 years they'd had an out-of-pocket medical bill of at least $400. Amen. I'll go along with that. And half said they were extremely or very concerned about being able to afford it, according to a nationally representative Consumer Reports survey of 1,079 adults fielded in early March. As the coronavirus continues its destructive path, the financial situation has become even more dire. By early April, more than 16 million Americans had already lost their jobs, and often the health insurance that comes with their employment. These realities put the shortcomings of our health care system, how care is paid for, who has access, into even starker relief. A Kaiser Family Foundation, KFF, poll published in mid-March, before much of the country shut down to stem the spread of the virus, found that 1/3 of people worried they couldn't afford coronavirus testing or treatments if they were sickened by the virus. The uninsured are the most financially vulnerable, but costs can also be a struggle for the estimated 81 million Americans who have high-deductible health plans, HDHPs. They must pay at least the first $1,400 out-of-pocket for an individual or $2,800 for a family before their coverage begins. Another problem, even for people with health coverage, it's surprise medical bills which people can face when they get care from an out-of-network provider, as can happen in emergencies. To blunt some of this finance fallout, President Donald Trump in March signed the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. The law mandates that all insurance plans, Medicare, Medicaid, Military, Affordable Care Act, ACA, and employer cover the cost of a coronavirus test, roughly $50, and any related doctor's appointment, copays, or fees. That might not address all the health care and hospital costs related to the coronavirus or the surprise medical bills a consumer may face. Those additional costs can be substantial, even just to get a diagnosis. That's because in addition to the coronavirus test, doctors sometimes need to administer other blood tests and sometimes x-rays to rule out the flu or pneumonia. For example, a person in Seattle with severe symptoms of the coronavirus, high fever, cough, and significant trouble breathing, who goes to a doctor's office can expect to pay about $1,000 for the appointment and testing, according to analysis from Castlight Health, a group that works with employers to lower the health care costs. In some places, such as New York City and Miami, prices could be even higher. Treatment for COVID-19 could be especially expensive if you need to go to the ER or admitted to the hospital, says Lauren Adler, Associate Director of the USA Brookings Schaeffer Institute for Health Policy at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Of course, for some families, it doesn't take the rampage of the coronavirus for a medical situation to topple their finances. In September 2019, in Grass Valley, California, Bridget Brandon's 9-year-old son had 3 of his fingers accidentally crushed by a slammed door. The family rushed the emergency room. While their plan had only a $500 ER fee, Brandon said, they found it up with bills from the hospital and doctor for nearly $2,000. They're still paying $50 installments. I have to triage my bills every month, she said. Whether you face high health care costs because of the coronavirus or another medical condition, there's what you can do to lower your financial risk. If you lost your health insurance, given that about 1/2 of Americans get insurance through an employer, the huge number of people losing their jobs may suddenly find that they no longer have coverage, says Christian Link Young, a fellow at USC Brookings Institute. What happens to you, time is the essence. You don't want to be caught uninsured during this period of high peril, and because in some cases you must sign up for new insurance within 60 days of losing your job, Young says. Here are some options. See whether you qualify for Medicaid. The ACA, passed in 2010 to provide insurance for more people, allowed states to expand their medical programs, something 36 states in the District of Columbia have done. In those locations, individuals with a monthly income of up to $1,467 and families with a monthly income up to $3,013 qualify, according to KFF. In other states, the annual median income limit for Medicaid is about $8,700 for a family of 3. to establish eligibility based on current monthly income, not income before you lost your job, check with the Centers for Medicare and Medical Services at healthcare.gov, says Cheryl Fish Parcham, Director of Access Initiatives at Family USA, which help consumers with health insurance problems. The rules vary by state, she says. The requirements may be different if you are pregnant, have children, or are disabled. You can apply for Medicaid at any time after you lose employment, provided insurance. If you're approved, coverage will begin the date of application or the first day of the month you applied, according to the CMS. Families with children under age 19, not covered by health insurance, should look to the CHIP, Children's Health Insurance Program. Go to healthcare.gov to determine eligibility. See if you qualify for a reduced-cost ACA plan. If your income is too high for Medicaid, you may still qualify for a subsidized ACA plan. Individuals who earn up to $51,040 and their families of four that earn up to $104,800 get reduced rates on those plans. In 2019, 87% of people in the ACA plans sold through the federal marketplace got subsidies and had an average monthly premium of $87. In response to the crisis, 11 states and Washington, D.C. opened special enrollment periods during the spring that uninsured people could sign up for an ACA plan to cover them for the rest of 2020. Previously, you could do this only if you experienced a qualified event such as a job loss or divorce. If you previously enrolled in an ACA plan and have experienced a loss of income, to check to see whether you now qualify for a larger subsidy. Consider COBRA. If you lose your insurance and work for the government agency or a company with more than 20 full-time employees, you must be offered an extension of your coverage under the Consolidated Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act, but you will pay the full amount because your employer will no longer contribute to your monthly premium. That's not great if you've just been laid off and have little money to pay for premiums, Fish Parcham says, but if your health care needs are better served by remaining on the same plan, at least for a while, this is an option. The monthly cost varies widely, but averages about $610 for an individual, $1,750 for a family, according to an analysis by the USC Brookings Institute. You'll have 60 days to enroll after you lose your employee coverage. Ask your employer when coverage through your job ends so that you know when to sign up. If you have a high-deductible health plan, in 2018, almost half of Americans insured through the employers or an ACA plan had HDHPs. These policies tend to have lower monthly premiums for much higher deductibles. When a family faces big medical bills, HDHP offers less financial protection. The IRS denies an HDHP as one with a minimum deductible of $1,400 for an individual or $2,800 for a family. But on average, these deductibles can be much higher. For people with combined medical and pharmacy deductibles, the average is $2,114 for an individual and $4,250 for a family, according to a 2018 employer survey by the Pharmacy Benefit Management Institute, a research group. For people who have ACA plans, deductibles can be even steeper. According to the KFF, deductibles for silver plans that include prescription drugs average $4,544 for an individual, bronze plans, $6,506. Among those who purchased insurance on their own and not through a federal or state marketplace, two-thirds said if they were hospitalized with the coronavirus, they would be unable to pay their deductible all at once, according to a March 2020 survey by the eHealth, an online marketplace where people can purchase private health insurance. Although you can't change the deductible once you sign up for a plan, you might be able to limit what you pay out of pocket, particularly if you need tests or treatment because of the coronavirus. Here's how. Found out whether drugs and treatments are covered before the deductible has been met. A 2019 federal rule allows insurance to cover certain treatments before a deductible is met. The rule includes several common drugs, such as those used to treat high cholesterol or blood pressure, heart failure, osteoporosis, and asthma, as well as insulin for diabetes. Certain insurers have already implemented this change, and more may soon, says Brian Marcotti, CEO of Business Group on Health, an organization that helps large employers manage health care equity and cost. Given the urgency of the pandemic, insurers have been able to adopt a similar rule to cover coronavirus treatments before a deductible is met, says Lauren Adler at the U.S. Brookings Schaefer, For example, Aetna announced in late March that it was waiving copays for people hospitalized at an in-network facilities for COVID-19 treatment or related complications. Most Aetna employer plans will automatically offer this benefit, says Ethan Slavin, spokesperson for Aetna. Blue Cross Blue Shield, Signature, and Humana have also said they will waive copays and cost sharing for testing or treatment related to COVID-19 in some of their plans. Use your health savings account. An HSA, which allows you to sock away tax-free funds to pay for future medical expenses up to $3,500 for an individual and $7,000 for a family per year, is one of the best ways to manage your health care costs. If you have one, you can use this money to pay for any qualifying medical service, including deductibles. You can also roll over unspent funds from year to year. For medical care that you can plan ahead for, shopping around can save you money because the price of medical services can vary substantially depending on the provider, says Courtney Lamy at Castlight Health. For example, a patient in Cleveland needing blood tests and an x-ray to screen for the coronavirus can pay as little as $241 or as much as $2,570 at different urgent care centers. In Dallas, someone could pay from $231 to $4,510. A price comparison website such as Guru or an app like My Medical Shopper can help you compare the prices of various procedures, tests, or surgeries among providers in your area. If you get a surprise medical bill, these charges are billed to you when you receive a service or treatment from a provider not in your insurance network. This can happen in emergencies that you can't always control where or from you get care. That was a Kate from Alyssa Yanero of Lockhart, Texas, when she experienced complications during childbirth. She said she was told that the hospital was in-network, but it turned out that the anesthesiologist was not, nor were the providers in the neonatal intensive care unit. Janero received bills for more than $30,000. It took 2 years and the help of an attorney to get the bill down to $10,000. About half of all states have enacted consumer protections against surprise bills, but only 13 provide comprehensive protections, according to analysis for the Commonwealth Fund, a nonprofit health policy research group. For almost a year, by the way, North Carolina does not provide any of those protections. For almost a year, Congress has been considering legislation to offer protection nationally, says Chuck Bell, Program Director for Advocacy at CR. Because COVID-19 treatments can be a big source of these bills, the need to address the problems is now even more urgent, Bell says. In a slowing economy, people will have even less income and resources to deal with surprise medical bills, he says. The emerging COVID-19 public health crisis underscores the need for Congress to pass comprehensive legislation to fix this serious national problem. To avoid surprise bills, whenever possible, find out ahead of time what providers your insurance does and does not cover. Should you still receive a bill, as Janero did, take these steps. Hold off on paying the bill. Patients often receive bills from doctor's offices, hospital, and other providers before they're even sent to a person's insurance company, says Caitlin Donovan, Senior Director for Public Relations at Patient Advocate Foundation, which helps consumers with health insurance problems. When you get a bill, don't pay it the right away. Instead, Donovan says, wait until you receive your explanation of benefits or your EOB. That will ensure that your insurer has received your provider's claim and hasn't been sent straight to you. Make sure charges and coverage are correct. Bonus says fully half of all medical bills contain errors, lab tests you never had, or providers you never saw, for example. Contact the provider or facility to point them out and ask for a revised bill. Also confirm with your insurer what is considered in-network and out-of-network and whether the coverage decision was a mistake. It's even worth asking whether your insurer will cover an out-of-network charge or is an in-network service, Donovan says. It never hurts to ask, she adds. Know your rights. Depending on the type of insurance you have, your state may have protections against surprise billing, Bell says. These either ban surprise billing outright or hold consumers harmless. So they aren't responsible for the bill. But just because the state has a ban surprise billing doesn't mean you won't receive a surprise bill anyway, Bell said. So be prepared to fight. Negotiate with the provider and appeal to the insurer. If you're stuck with an out-of-network charge, go on the offensive, Bell says. Contact the provider and explain that your insurance is charging you the full out-of-network care rate and you must pay entirely out-of-pocket. Ask whether the provider will charge you its discounted in-network rate instead, Donovan says. Also find out whether the hospital provider offers any financial assistance or if it will let you pay the charge over time, says Cheryl Fish-Bartram at Families USA. You can also ask whether it would consider offering discount if you paid a lump sum. If you can't reach an agreement with the provider, appeal to the insurer's decision, Donovan says. You'll want a letter that explains your situation, why you believe the insurer should cover your health problems, if possible, why covering the cost now could prevent future medical expenses. Be advised this can take up to 60 days for most employer-provided and ACA health plans. If the appeal doesn't work, you can request a view by a third party, Donovan says. The insurer is required to send you information on how to initiate the process. Get help. If you're having trouble and appealing to the insurer, you can contact your state's Consumer Assistance Program, if it has one, or insurance department. Go to local help healthcare for more details. Also contact Patient Advocate Foundation at 1-800-532-5274, 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Monday through Thursday, or online at patientadvocate.org. Design to Grind. It's a product update on garbage disposals. Garbage disposals do double duty, meeting the often compelling demands of convenience and conservation. They pulverize leftovers from peach pits to corn cobs to fish bones, so you can send them down the drain instead of hauling them to the trash. Washing food waste down the drain also means less of it ends up in landfills, where it can emit harmful greenhouse gases as it breaks down. Instead, food waste is ground into disposal, ends up in a sewage treatment plant, unless you have a septic system. When processed the right way, this is even more environmentally friendly than composting, according to David Dewis, director of Deer Island Treatment Plant in Boston. Like many U.S. major U.S. wastewater plants, Deer Island converts the gas generated from food waste into biofuel to power the plant. The remaining solids are turned into fertilizer for farms. So if you are considering installing or replacing a disposal but are concerned about the environmental impact, find out how your local sewage treatment plant processes the town's wastewater. You also need to be careful because some places actually ban garbage disposals. A recently nationally representative survey of 1,000 U.S. adults shows that just over half of Americans live in homes with a garbage disposal. More than 60% of those who said did the disposal was already installed when they moved in. According to the Association of Home Appliance Manufacturers, these kitchen workhorses last about 11 years. How will you know when yours is about to go kaput? Leaking, taking longer to grind, and making louder noises than usual are signs. So is having to use the reset button frequently. The button is like a circuit breaker that needs to be reset after the disposal shuts off, typically because of a strain on the motor. Our buying advice and ratings of almost 2 dozen models will help you make the best choice, depending on your situation. Can your pipes handle it? If you're considering installing a garbage disposal for the first time, make sure your pipes are up to the task. Food debris might not present a problem in a newer home with slippery plastic drain pipes, says Paul Abrams, Public Relations Director at Roto-Rooter. But clog risks might go up substantially if you have an old cast iron drain pipes. Polyvinyl chloride, or PVC piping, became more common in home builds after the mid-70s. If your pipes already clog often, a disposal might not be for you. You should also think twice if you rely on a septic system. Disposal manufacturers insist their products are safe to use with septic systems, but some plumbers are equally adamant that they are not. The truth probably lies somewhere in between and may depend on the size of your system and how often you pump it. If you have a septic system you want to install a disposal, check first with your septic system inspector. Once you're sure that your plumbing can handle it, measure under the sink to make sure you have room for the disposal, says Larry Kufo, who oversees CR's garbage disposal test. The appliance attached directly to the underside of your sink's drain opening. There is no standard garbage disposal size. The models we tested range from 10 to 16 inches high, 5 to 9 inches wide, and 6 to 13 inches deep. Generally, the more sound insulation, the bigger the unit. How to clean your garbage disposal. Garbage disposals seem to make leftovers vanish, but over time, tiny flecks of food build up and create foul odors. Cleaning your grinder once a week will help you avoid the stink in your sink. I like that, stink in your sink. Disposal maker and sink aerator recommends putting 6 ice cubes down the drain, followed by a tablespoon of baking soda, 3 thin lemon slices, and 1 teaspoon of bleach. Top that off all off with 6 more ice cubes. Then turn the disposal on without running water until you hear the grinding stop. and flush with cold water while the motor is running. Moen, which also makes disposal, suggests removing the rubber splash guard attached to the opening, where food grime tends to cling. Unplug the unit first. Scrub it with warm water and baking soda or pop it into the dishwasher. To help control odors, run cold water before you turn on the disposal while grinding food, and then for about 7 seconds after you hear the grinding stop. Choosing the right type. The best model for you depending on your budget, the size of your household, and how much food you need to grind on a regular basis. The garbage disposals cost between $50 and $500. Less expensive models usually have a small motor and a one-year warranty. A premium price doesn't necessarily buy a better performance, but it does buy a longer warranty and premium features such as thicker sound insulation, sturdier stainless steel components, multiple grind stages, and auto-reversing grinders that help prevent jams. For a convenient, budget-friendly disposal, consider your continuous feed model, which is the most common type. Flip a switch and the grinder revs into action so you can clean up as you go. Standard wall switches are sold separately and should be installed by an electrician. Foods you can and can't put down a garbage disposal. The term garbage disposal is actually a misnomer because those powerful grinders are designed to handle food waste exclusively. But there are some edible things you avoid tossing in. Always check your model's manual for a list of foods it can and can't handle. The average garbage disposal can grind almost all the food waste you throw in, but your plumbing is another story. Yes, vegetable scraps, ice, fruit scraps, fruit pits, cooked meat, small bones, and corn cobs can all be ground. No, fibrous foods such as corn husk, artichokes, celery, and asparagus. Coffee grounds should not be put in it. I didn't know that. Vegetable peels, clam or oyster shells, oil, eggshells, grease, or starchy foods. None of those should be put in a garbage disposal. So if you feel like you need to do that, then you probably need to get yourself a new garbage disposal. And once again, let's close out with a couple of laugh lines. And the theme for this is coming clean. My twins hate to brush their teeth, so I just convinced them that it's fun to brush someone else's teeth. Problem solved. They brush each other's teeth. The fact that Head and Shoulders doesn't have a body wash called Knees and Toes disappoints me. I'm sick of men's 3-in-1 body wash shampoo conditioner. Throw toothpaste in there, too. Dove chocolate tastes so much better than their soap. And with that, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest of Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'll repeat that, 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks.